connecting our university city
and South Cambridgeshire.
Cambridge 105 Radio.
What's it like? Delicious.
Good afternoon and welcome to Flavour with Alan Alder, Sue Bailey and me, Matt Bentman. Our thanks to Ollie Slack for an hour of football. Now we are here to talk about food and drink. Here's Alan and Sue with what we've got for you today.
Yeah, we have some fascinating food history from Lizzie Collingham, who is a local writer, and a bit of food cultural history from Trumpington, where Matt engaged in the ancient ritual of wassailing. We also have some very up-to-date food news from Provenance Bricks and Mortar, the new deli cafe restaurant that's opening on Wednesday.
And we've a taste of warmer climes in our feature on Il Molino, the stall at Cambridge's Sunday Market. They bring you award-winning produce direct from a farm in Italy. We also take a trip to the vegan Vice City, and we find a bit about what some are seeing as a potential threat to Cambridge Market.
But let's start with some good market news.
Yes, the Sunday Market here in Cambridge is a real pleasure. There are lots of food stalls, some rather hidden away, so there's a nice sense of exploration. Last Sunday, I came across a beautiful stall, Il Molino, selling Italian products. Owner Sede Sutede gave me some samples, but first told me how he came to start up his business.
It all was a coincidence because we went to this farm as a holiday about 8 years ago. And loved the place and realized that it was an olive oil production farm. And over the years, we've been back every year and we got to know Annalisa, who runs the farm, and it's been in her family for generations. And she was looking for someone to represent her products here in the UK. I was teaching at the time and I was about to retire, and I thought this would be a nice hobby to do as on a Sunday market. So that is how we started many, many years ago. We've been here on the Cambridge Market for about 4 years, and we're here every Sunday, and we have a variety of products from the farm, and everything here is grown, picked, pressed, bottled on the farm.
So all totally organic?
Totally organic, and it's using methods of farming which have been used for centuries there to make sure that the goodness is put back into the soil for future generations, which is something very important to Annalisa, who runs the farm. For our latest de-stoned Canino olive oil, we just got Slow Food Italia has given us recognition for the methods of organic production and how the goodness is put back into the soil. The farm is based in Lazio region, which is south of Tuscany, north of Rome, near a wonderful lake called Lake Bolsena, where Italians go for their annual holiday. And it is a beautiful farm and the olive groves which across there.
Tell me a bit more about the different products she produces.
Yes, we have, at the moment, we have three varieties of olive oil. There is the one from a black Frantoi olive, which with the stone in, which is quite, which is perhaps our strongest tasting olive oil. The other two are from a Canino olive, one which has the stone in, and the other one is de-stoned. What happens is that when the olive is picked, the stone is taken out, and what that does is to produce a higher quality oil with higher antioxidants and polyphenols. And it has been our most popular selling oil during Christmas. In fact, we sold out. We had, you know, people who were almost fighting over it because I had the last two or three bottles left. But thankfully, we have everything back in stock now for people to enjoy. And even this morning we had a lady who tried it and she was really, really impressed by the quality of the oil. Yeah, it's nice being on the market because you meet people, you actually talk to people, whereas online it seems can be, people cannot even try the olive oil. Whereas here they can come, they can taste not just the olive oil but our jams and our beauty products, just to have a tester to see what it feels like. So I think it's the social aspect which is really important for us.
Tell me a bit more about the jams. What types of jams are there?
We have plum, apricot, and our speciality is sour cherry, which is, again, our best seller. And these are, again, all organically grown on the farm. And we were recently at the farm about 2 months ago. We went to help with the olive picking harvest, which was quite an experience. I realised how hard work it is, the amount of work that the workers on the farm put in. harvest starts in October and lasts just before Christmas. And once the olives are picked, they are brushed with a tractor and they fall to the ground. And our job was to pick them off the nets on the ground and put them in baskets. And straight away they're taken to the farm to be destoned or washed and cleaned and pressed, so that you can see the juice of the olive coming through. It's a very sort of beautiful green colour. And then it is filtered and put into tanks with nitrogen to use nitrogen, because if you use any other gas, it's going to oxidize it and destroy the quality of the olive. So they are kept in nitrogen tanks and then bottled, basically.
Perfect, as simple as that.
It's very simple, yes. Yeah.
And what about the different types of pressings of olive? Can you explain a bit more about that?
Well, these are all cold pressed, so no heat is given during the process, which will destroy the quality of the olive. So it's cold pressed. The highest quality oils will be cold pressed, and ours is one of the highest qualities that you get. We have got many awards for the olive oil. Japan, 2016, Japan, and as I said, Slow Food Italia, and also it's in Italy, there's a couple of awards for the olive oil.
Fantastic. So really nice quality. Let's go and try some.
So we have three varieties of olive, as well as the infused ones, which I didn't tell you about. We have lemon-infused, chili and garlic, parsley and basil. But our base oils are, the first one is the black Frantoi with the stone in, which is this one. And as you can see, it's a little bit solidifying because it's
quite cold today, cold. Yes.
But it shows you the quality of the oil. Nothing is put in to keep it fluid.
It's got a real grassy...
Yeah. Yes, and you should get the pepper right at the end, at the back of your throat, at the end.
Yep, that's come through.
Yeah. So that's the black Frantoi, and we've just got some really lovely new bottles for them. The middle one that we have is from the green Canino olive, which is the variety of olive which is prevalent in the region in Lazio. And that is suitable for cooking with, as well as sort of salad dressing.
That's a much... Oh, but that's peppery too.
Yeah.
Wow.
And our highest quality one is the same green Canino, but it's the one which is de-stoned. And that has been our best-selling one. It's really,
really
fresh.
Really smooth and yum.
Yeah.
Some more of that one.
Oh, yeah, go ahead. As I said, the health benefits of olive oil...
Well, one should consume oil, consume it wisely, but consume good quality
oil. Good quality oil, yes. Yeah.
And I see also you've got a Cambridge Award, Cambridge Food Award.
Yeah,
how
we
nice.
Were very surprised. There are secret shoppers who come round, which is obviously promoted by Cambridge Bid. And we won the best overall customer experience last year, 2018, for market trading.
Which
was very good. So we had a ceremony at St John's College with the mayor and...
Well deserved. So. And your stall is lovely, and I love the little olive trees as well. It's perfect.
Yeah, they've lasted quite a few years.
It's excellent. Thank you. So come basically Sunday when all the foods are on Cambridge Market, and come visit Il Melino.
Yes, and try our olive oils.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, that sounds really good. And it really sums up for me what the Sunday market is about, really. You know, the stall holders generally, at any rate, the food stall holders on Sunday market, are really interested in what they're selling. They really know about it. They're really concerned to have good quality, aren't
they? It's lovely. I love going there on a Sunday. It's such a fun thing to do.
Yeah. And often in Simon Steele's vegetable stall, there are conversations about food going on, about how you cook this, what you do with that. It's a wonderful experience.
It's a real pleasure.
Now, Miami Vice featured Crockett and Tubbs. Vegan Vice features Tommy and Connor, two lads determined to make an impact on the vegan scene in Cambridge. So, get ready to swap your meat for two veg. This is Vegan Vice Club.
So here's the thing. Originally, I mean, me and Connor, we had a mad road trip down where we got inspired with a bunch of food and we had a great time in Miami. But actually, Vice, that is just a coincidence. You know, we don't pigeonhole as 80s. We kind of see it as a brand that's trying to time travel and produce an alternate reality where vegan is the way.
The way.
Vegan is the way.
and that we have all these cool fast food companies that didn't exist in the 70s and 80s, but kind of exist now.
You and your cousin Connor.
Yeah.
You're both vegan from a really young age.
Well, actually, no, we're relatively recent. See, Connor is an amazing chef and, you know, a new challenge to chef skills to be able to make food taste the same, if not better.
Yeah.
And with more original flavor than its meat-based equivalents. For myself, I think it was a series of a disillusionment with the way that we frame animals in a way of taste, and what's on my plate is not something grown, but it's something born and farmed intensively in a way that is profitable for companies to sell it and cheap enough for me to buy.
Veggie and vegan burgers started in the 1930s. You could buy them in a can. By the 1980s, a restaurateur in London sold the veggie burger as if you were about to take a trip into space. It needed to be rehydrated, shaped into patties, and cooked. Veggie burgers made the White House menu 25 years ago. And 10 years ago, a company called Beyond Meat was founded by Bill Gates, Jack Dorsey, and Evan Williams from Twitter. Its mission? To replace the protein you get from meat with protein you can get instead from plants. So, Vegan Vice.
Vegan Vice.
Had a Wednesday stall at the Cambridge Market. Now you can find them at Taboosh as part of the Veganuary Takeover pop-up. This is their first bricks and mortar premises.
When me and Connor were scouting out the market and were figuring out how to build our stall there, because we had to build a small one that would just fit bespoke for the little promo we're doing in Cambridge, we just walked past this place because I remember it from back in the days, you know, out in Cambridge as a student. I went up to the manager and I kind of just dropped our card and said, look, you know, we're a vegan fast food company that are trying to make waves here in Cambridge and really boost up the vegan scene here. So that was it. Me and Connor had a mission to really show them what our food is made of. And come our first day in Cambridge, we had queues and they came and saw, you know, that, wow, demand really is here.
Yeah.
They ordered everything off the menu and loved it all. And the next day they sat us down in their office and they said, well, you know, let's do this.
Pete Rawlings.
My name is Pete. I'm head of operations for Lavazza Around the Corner and Taboosh. We've welcomed Vegan Vice in to complement our drinks with their great vegan burgers. It's more of a kitchen residency, and we're still Taboosh, as everyone knows and loves it upstairs.
Now, there's the quarter pound Vice burger.
Yes, that is really our quotation mark beef patty, and that's what all the flavours are paired with. Out of those, we have, you know, the original American-y flavours of ketchup, mustard, and those kind of ones. But then we have our signature peanut butter barbecue sauce, which every time people read it on the menu and they stop in their tracks and they say, well, I'm gonna have to try what this is all about.
Exactly.
I don't know why it hasn't been done before, but they're just a perfect mix of that kind of smokiness from the barbecue and nuttiness and sweet tang from peanuts when they're roasted properly. And so we homemade all these sauces and put them with a Vice burger. We love peanut, we love barbecue. We start putting these things together. And yes, they can be done wrong, but when you do them right, it's like introducing a new colour to the world, you know.
All of their sauces, all of their ingredients are vegan. When I arrived, Tommy was hauling in a barrow full of product.
So that was actually chickpea, and we used the aquafaba from chickpea to whip up and make our egg-free mayonnaise.
Oh.
And then we herb and spice it to get all the range of flavours that we put on our menu.
Aquafaba.
Faba.
Dr. Sue Bailey.
Aquafaba.
You can use aquafiber from chickpea to make a lot of things. It's a very flexible product. You can make it to use desserts, which people do.
It makes the most perfect marshmallow mixture.
On the Great British Bake Off, that's when it became, you know, really popular again.
Yeah.
When they're making meringues from it.
So if you're a vegan or a vegetarian, this is the most brilliant egg white substitute.
Meanwhile, back to the burgers.
I'm gonna jump in the volcano.
So marry me and then jump in the volcano.
We also have this one called the El Volcano. You have to say it like that. And we stack it real high, you know, it's got tortilla and nacho chips in the burger, you know, for kind of our spicy hummus with homegrown chilies and all these kind of things. They're just all really interesting, different burgers that, vegan or not vegan, you want to try these because they look and sound good and the flavours don't exist anywhere else.
Yeah. They got Pete's seal of approval.
I love meat. I think I always will.
Yeah.
I've always been very sceptical when people talk to me about vegan burgers. And to be honest, I hadn't ever tried a vegan burger before I'd met these guys. I went into it being very sceptical and was blown away. these guys obviously have a real passion for what they do. They use great quality ingredients. They love experimenting with flavours, something that we love doing here as well. And I enjoyed it as much as I have done, you know, beef burgers, chicken burgers. Yeah, it was great.
So 2 years vegan, you're a big guy. I mean, your arm's thicker than my leg. So there's a lot of protein in what you're eating. And I think that's what brings me on to my next question.
Sure.
Because you do both soy patties in your burgers.
Correct.
But you also do seitan. Did I pronounce that correctly?
Yeah, seitan. I mean, we call it, we don't like using that word because it sounds too much like Satan.
Yeah.
Satan is a name she goes by. So we call it the tender crop, and what it is, it's a gluten and chickpea based mix that can be manipulated in a way to give it a chickeny texture.
Mm.
And so it's 80% protein, incredibly nutritious, and it's also a complete protein. You know, one of these new things that people didn't realize exists, but it does, as a very, very good substitute. And when you cook it and flavor it the way that we do, it's very comparable to chicken food.
Tommy was just talking about the tender crop chicken burger, which is a combination of gluten, wheat and chickpea. So you've tried that. How would you describe the texture yourself?
In terms of texture, it's got that succulent and juicy and moist and flavoursome on the inside, but on the outside it's got that real crunchy, crispy coating that you want. So that real contrast in textures. Mm. Yeah.
There is definitely a knack to it. Making seitan is not easy. To cook it and flavour it in a way where you're getting that texture and that taste is a different matter altogether.
Getting the texture and the taste is a different matter.
And that was an old airplane gag.
Surely you can't be serious.
I am serious. And don't call me Shirley.
What is the vegan vibe in Cambridge? Let's get it up and running, you know? And this is just the beginning, you know, food. We're really hoping to do way much more. Time will tell.
Well, Tommy D, thanks very much for your time.
Yeah, I appreciate it big time for having me. Thank you.
I'll let you get back to your work.
Nice one. Time. All right, cheers.
And you're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105 Radio.
Flavour, that's a cool name.
Yeah, that was Tommy D of Vegan Vice Club. They opened on Tuesday this week, and you know what? I think they've been interviewed by just about every media outlet in the city over the last few weeks, so proving popular, perhaps. If you'd like to get a look at their product, you can check out their website. It's veganvice.club.
We aim to bring you the up-to-date food news on flavour. It's also very interesting, however, to look back at food history. It's one of my really big interests, so I was delighted to be able to chat with South Cambridgeshire-based writer Lizzie Collingham about her books on the subject. I began by asking her how she got started.
The thing is, I started off as an academic and I wrote a PhD on the British body in India. So it's all about how you use your body as an instrument of rule, how you use it at your postures, your gestures, how often you wash, which is quite important in India, what you wear and, of course, what you eat as a way of demonstrating your prestige, your status, your role as a ruler in India. And so that's how I got into food, because the British in India are fascinating. So they start off in the late 18th, early 19th century, quite happy to be thought of as East Indians or Anglo-Indians. They're happy to have India in their name. They think they're bringing back India into a glorious rule, era of rule, how it was ruled before the Mughals came along and ruined everything. And so they lie around in pyjamas, they smoke hookahs, they watch Nautch Girls, which are Indian dancing girls, and of course they eat curry and rice happily. Their table is always laden with piles of meat, huge capons and turkeys and sirloins of beef in India, and also bowls of curry and rice. And then, as they change their idea about what they should be doing, who they are, they see themselves as symbols of British civilization, bringing British civilization to the Indians, who are they regard more and more contemptuously and more racistly, and that means that they slowly reject Indian food, and it becomes less and less okay to eat, to go native and eat curry and rice. So curry disappears off the dinner table and is only acceptable at lunch, or you might have kedgeree for breakfast. And then it gradually, by the 1920s, 1930s, it's just absolutely not acceptable to eat Indian food. So you eat horrible tin p- peas and bully
imported all the way to India.
Yeah, absolutely. And dried bony fish, as E.M. Forster so beautifully describes it. And curry might be something you would eat, a very hot one, for lunch at the club on a Sunday or something like that. So that process of rejecting indifference, and you can see that not just in food but in all kinds of other areas of their lives. And that's, in a way, kind of how I... That's my first foray into food history. In my last book, The Hungry Empire, I wrote about, you know, things that people would assume would be boring, like trade and the economics of the sugar trade or the tea trade and so on. But because I start each chapter with a meal, and so I try to draw people in, get them interested in the characters, show that these big processes affected people's lives in small ways, and our lives are equally affected in the same way. What we eat on our dining tables tonight will be affected by large processes. So I try to show people how that happens. So that's how I use food. So as a way into history and a way of something that people can connect to. Everybody eats in a particular way. And so food is a very good way to draw people in and show how it affects normal people and characters and everyday life.
And your book is very well researched and fascinating nuggets of information all the way through. How did you select what to include and what to exclude?
That's painful, actually. I spend far too long in the library. That's my favourite bit. Okay, so I love going into the library, and I spend, you know, far too long, too many years doing that because it's so enjoyable. And so I read lots and lots of I pick out little stories and read as many memoirs and things like that as I possibly can. And with The Hungry Empire, I got really interested because Ireland exported salt butter to the West Indies, and North America to the North American colonies in the 18th century. And what was really interesting was that many of the plantations in Ireland had a connection to with the West Country, and in Biddeford. Biddeford was the centre for pottery in this period. So they would make little pots, and then the pots would be put in a ship, taken to Ireland. The Irish would fill them with butter, and then they would be taken to North America and West India. And I just got completely fascinated by this. And people said, it's not really in the line of the story. I said, but it's such a wonderful bit. So I put it in. So I do get distracted, and I'm always trying to stuff as much in as possible. But I think that makes it more interesting.
Okay. For people who haven't read your book, just talk a little bit about the premise behind your book, The Hungry Empire.
The Hungry Empire. How you organise your society in order to bring it, to get the food supply, has very wide ramifications. So in the 19th century, Britain exports its farming, and it exports the people who do the farming to the colonies and the dominions, and so they set up farms and so on in Australia and New Zealand, and then they make sheep and lamb, and that's imported back into Britain. And by the 1930s, the working classes, who are of course working in the industries producing the manufactured goods, which are then sold to make the money to buy the food, they are fed on food that's largely imported. Food supply question structured so much of British society, and that's, I guess, the conceit that I started with.
Because we tend to think of food industrialisation and food processing as a much more contemporary thing, whereas your book really explains that it's not.
It really starts in the 18th, 19th centuries. That's when, and biscuits are a very good example. So biscuits are one of the first manufactured foods. So during the 18th century, Britain was always at war with someone, France and Spain and Holland. And in order to feed the sailors durable foods that aren't going to go off, they made ship's biscuit. You know, as the wars ratcheted up and reached their peak in the Revolutionary and Napoleonic Wars at the end of the 18th century, they're making the biscuits to the point where they can barely get them out of the ovens into their sacks and onto the ship before, you know, the next lot come and wants more, because there's such a high demand. And then they develop a way of making them on an assembly line. Each person gets their task. One person kneads, one person cuts them out, one person puts the oven. And as, of course, the Industrial Revolution gets going, somebody has the clever idea to make a machine that does this. So you get a steam-powered dough kneader, and then you get a special thing which is like a designed like a newspaper cutting thing machine, printing machine, which prints out the biscuits, and then a conveyor belt oven where they go through on a conveyor belt. And so they industrialise the manufacture of biscuits, and so that's one of the first industrialised two bakers in Carlisle. Cars we still know of, and Huntley and Palmer's in Reading, they have the idea that they're going to take that and make sweet biscuits as well as, you know, things like crackers for cheese. And that's two of the very first really big industries and factories that make food. When I wrote my book on food in the Second World War, to my surprise, I discovered that actually food was a driver towards war. So the Germany wanted to achieve autarky. It wanted to be able to be to have an independent food supply. And obviously, within Germany, that's going to be difficult. So they looked to the east, and the whole idea of Lebensraum comes from that drive, that desire to be able to take over the Ukraine and grow all your wheat to feed all your people in Germany. And so that's a big push. And they want an empire like Britain has an empire. They're jealous of it. And they don't want, of course, to follow Britain's route, which is to open themselves to trade, because Hitler had the mad idea that this is all a Jewish conspiracy or something. They don't want to open themselves to the world. So they want to be enclosed, and they want other people's land to grow their food. And in Japan too, that's a reason why Japan wants to expand into China. They want the Manchuria to grow soybeans to feed their population. How you get your food, how you secure your food supply, your ideology of how that's acceptable to do that, free trade or autarky, has enormous worrying political implications. And
how long did it take you to write your book, most recent one?
Too long.
And how did you decide on whose story to base each chapter on? Was that tricky?
Yes. Mm-hmm. So I had the conceit that I would start each chapter with a real meal, and I thought, oh, that'll be possible. I shouldn't have known better. I've done research before. It was so hard. Everybody in the empire ate a really boring diet of salt meat, ship's biscuit or flour made into an unleavened bread, bit of beans, you know, rum, salt, sugar, tea, and the same old boring meal everywhere you went. So yes, I had to be quite inventive, and it took quite a bit of rummaging about finding meals. And some of the meals I constructed from archaeological research. So, for example, the 18th century, I give a meal that the African slaves working in South Carolina on the rice plantations would have eaten. But of course, there's stuff written by slaves or ex-slaves on the experience of slavery in the 19th century, but there's nothing that I could find. I think I'm right in saying there isn't really anything written in the 18th century. But you do have really good archaeological sources from refuse dumps or from next to the slave cabins and things like that. So you can see what people were eating, and you can compare that to what they were eating in the big house, things like that. You also have, they have this amazing Gula language in South Carolina. So there's been lots of research on that. And so you could, if you follow the research on that, you can see it has lots of traces of what life would have been like and so on. And there's good academic research on 18th century slavery and so on. So I combined all of that to bring it together.
To create
a meal and a scene. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because there just isn't one. And I really wanted to talk. I didn't want to keep on doing it, all the meals to be from the perspective of the whites or the people in power or the colonialists. I wanted the people
everyone's
who are forgotten about to be included. Mm-hmm. So that's how I set about doing that.
Well, that's an amazing thing, isn't it? The food being a driver, or one of the drivers, towards World War II, and food also being a sort of a driver towards the establishment of empires. It's extraordinary.
Yes, I know. It's absolutely fascinating. I was given this book for Christmas because my husband knows I love food history. And it was a real pleasure to then be able to interview the author of this, because I'd known about Lizzie Collingham, and then to think, oh, wow, I can actually go to the horse's mouth and get the story about how she actually did the research and found out about this. And as you say, using it as a means of introduction to history, but also understanding things. Absolutely fascinating.
Well, it's amazing that food history extends into sort of world wars, isn't it? You know, it's not just what people used to eat for breakfast in the 1600s, you know, it's...
Oh, yes, contemporary food history is fascinating. Yes, yeah. Oh, yeah, oh, yeah, I love it.
Fantastic.
And that music signals time for the latest food tweets from the city.
Yes, it's amazing to move from food history to tweets of that came in this morning. But anyway, Reggae Kitchen have taken over the kitchen at 2648 in Trinity Street from Monday till Saturday, and they're there from 5 till 10 p.m. Today, Pizza Mondo are at Calverley's in Hooper Street from 12 till 3 and then again from 6 till 9. Also today, Pizza Passion are at the Black Horse Pub in Dry Drayton from 3 o'clock till 7 o'clock. And Roberto's Deli has tweeted to remind us that he's selling high-quality English and international cheese, handmade pork pies, sausage rolls and various things like that on Cambridge Market opposite Marks and Spencer's today, and in fact every day excluding Friday.
Now, on to a new place. Here's Alan.
There's a new place to eat opening on Wednesday. How does this sound?
So we'll have sea trout, which we'll smoke lightly on oak wood boards next to the fire. So we'll be serving that alongside scrambled eggs, spring onions, toasted brioche and fish caramel, a sauce made of fish sauce and caramel. And you can add chilies, star anise and coriander seeds, whatever you like, really.
All this... parsnip croquettes.
Yeah, they're amazing. So sweet. Roast them with rosemary, garlic, a little bit of thyme. Get a bit of colour on them and then cover them so they steam. And then once you can put your knife straight through them, put them in a food processor, blitz it, set them in the fridge just on their own, they'll set quite nicely. And then you can use your fingers quite simply, use a spoon, cornel them, whichever shape you like. And then just panny them, eggs, flour, breadcrumbs and deep fry.
With salad items and vegetables from the remarkable Flourish in Hildesham, how about this for brunch?
Local mushrooms, whipped ricotta, kale, parsley, garlic butter on his sourdough, and the kale we'll be getting from Flourish, which is Calixta. Calixta farms using two horses, workhorses, instead of tractors. So where your tractor would compact the ground, the soil was looser, more nutrients, healthier food.
That was Greg Proud, who, along with partner Kate Holden, runs Provenance Kitchen. And from this coming Wednesday, they will have a deli, cafe, restaurant in a building. It's on the edge of Whittlesford and called Provenance Bricks and Mortar. I spoke with them both on Tuesday and asked why they were moving indoors.
You know, we can explore more in the menus that we're creating and be more adventurous in the food that we're providing. Expectations of what people want out of a kind of on the street food side. When we were sending our restaurant quality food out, people were a little bit surprised and were expecting a pizza or a burger or, you know, something meat in bread kind of thing. And when we were putting out plates of chickpeas or lentils with whole fish and things, people were a little bit like, what's that kohlrabi? And so it didn't always marry up with people's expectations, so it didn't always work well for us. We're very excited about having the deli, the restaurant and the cafe all under one roof. I had a deli before, I'm excited about doing that. We're going to showcase, you know, Greg will showcase in the kitchen the produce that we're selling in the deli, and so it all will just work really well together.
But there are still plenty of opportunities for outdoor eating in fine weather.
The side in which the restaurant lays, we've got, we'll have bifold doors that will open out onto our courtyard, which is a lovely south-facing spot, perfect to sit out in and enjoy a glass of wine or something in the summer. We've got an Argentinian parrilla, which is a barbecue, essentially, using charcoal and wood to cook over. And we've been doing that again sort of since 2015 when we were working out externally at places like Thirsty in Cambridge, and also a pizza oven. So we're going to have a nice outdoor setup, again, you know, using our theme of cooking over wood and charcoal. Within that area as well, we're going to have vegetables and salads, herbs and things growing. We'll invite people to pick the herbs to enhance their dish if they wish as well. And also we've got about an acre of garden just outside of the restaurant, which will be perfect for events, parties, but just generally for our customers to enjoy. We're right next to Duxford Museum, so there's always a Spitfire or vintage aircraft flying over. We're going to get some binoculars for people to enjoy the sights. And yeah, just really make use of all the space that we've got here. It's a lot of space for everyone to enjoy.
Yeah.
Huge car park, so.
Kate mentioned the barbecue there. Cooking on fire will be how it's done, both indoors and out. Here's Greg talking about a dish that exemplifies their use of fire.
From day one, we've always had flank steak on the menu. And we've always cooked it on the airstream, seared it on the plancha, and then finished it on the coals in the wood oven. So that's been since day one. So, I mean, as soon as you cook any kind of beef, and the beef we use Hereford flank steak from Burton's Butchers based in Saffron Walden down the road. And flank steak's one of those it's a bit fashionable now, so the price has gone up a little bit, but it's quite a reasonable price cut of meat. And as soon as you hit it onto coals or over wood, it's amazing.
Yeah.
So we'll be cooking that an awful lot. That will stay on the menu pretty much full time.
A mention of steak turns my mind to wine and getting the right wine to match the food. Kate again, who said that they're getting their wines from Noel Young in Cambridge.
We're working with Noel Young. We've enjoyed some tasting sessions with him. We've tried the menu together with his wines, and so we've already have done some pairings for that, so that, you know, people can really get the best experience. It's all about customer experience here.
One of the features that will please a lot of people is that the brunch menu includes small plates. There's not enough small plates in Cambridge. Here's Greg.
It breaks it down a bit less formal, so you can share. So if two people are coming, you could get three dishes each, and really try the full menu rather than being stuck to one dish each.
Does that make it more expensive to produce? I mean, certainly in terms of labour at any rate.
No, not at all. No, not really. Makes it more fun, definitely.
Yeah, it does sound fun. So what is the place going to be like? I put that to Kate.
What's the feel going to be like? Is it a long and lazy place to have lunch, or is it a brisk and efficient place? What's it going to be like?
It's absolutely going to be both of those things. You know, our whole ethos is fast, slow food, which is about encouraging people to eat really well-produced, healthy food, taking their time. But at the same time, we appreciate that people are, you know, if we've got people coming in from businesses, that they will only have a limited amount of time. So the time that they've got, we want them to be able to enjoy a nice meal or take food away with them. So we'll be, you know, as Greg said, we've got small plates on the menu. The food that we're producing is very quick to put out because we've already put all the effort in before we open. So it will be absolutely perfect for businesses to come and have a meeting or have a lunch. We can get the food out and be really quick for them. But equally, for people that do have a longer amount of time to spend, then it's absolutely a place to just come and relax and enjoy the food, enjoy the watching the fire. And we've got, you know, fire in the cafe as well, a nice open fire, and people can just sit back and relax. And the same on a Sunday. Just, you know, come and flick through the recipe books that we've got on the shelves, look through the local papers and things like that. So perfect for families too. We've got huge family facilities, so really welcome all.
And finally, if you're wondering if this means goodbye to Provenance's Airstream and Horse Box, here's the answer.
No, not at all. We'll probably train back on some smaller events that we do, but predominantly we will still be taking it at weddings, private parties and private events. And the Horse Box will still be going out doing its local business lunches. So we turn up to businesses in their car park and we do their lunches for them. Same kind of menu as we do here at the cafe.
And that is Provenance Bricks and Mortar in Whittlesford, which is opening this coming Wednesday.
But whereabouts is it exactly?
Well, the way I got it, it's really, really easy to get to. I went down the M11, turned off at junction 10 and turn towards Whittlesford, and then there's almost immediately there's a road off on the
back route. Yes.
And you go up the road on the left. That is Hill Farm Road, and it's just a few hundred yards up there, so it's really close to the motorway. It's very easy to
Now I know exactly where it is. Thank you. Brilliant.
And here's news of some free food available now in Cambridge and South Cambridgeshire, which you can find on the Olio app.
Yes, the Olio app has revealed today Alexandra, who lives on Adam Brooks Road, has various expired cans with best before dates between 2016 to 2018. Cans of corn, cans of tomatoes, lentils, baked beans, olives, carrots and plenty more. Pick-up times are flexible, or she can drop them off for you around Trumpington Way. Next up, Sarah, near St Andrew the Great Church in the city centre, has a half-used 800-gram bag of infant milk for newborns to 6 months. So if you are a newborn and you're listening to Flavour, and why not, and you're in the need of some formula, this could be your lucky day. Pickup times are flexible. And finally, as people clear out their Christmas stock, Mim in Horningsea has some mincemeat to give away, which she can leave in a safe place for you. So that's just a little snippet of what we've got on Olio today.
Well, wassail, that's Anglo-Saxon for be in good health. It celebrates Christmas, winter and the bountiful harvest to come.
Yeah, our nearest wassail was in Trumpington Orchard last Sunday. It was freezing cold, the clouds were fit to burst, but the people all had smiles on their faces, singing to the apple trees as darkness fell.
People seem to forget that around Cambridge, up north towards Ely and the Wisbech, was one of the biggest apple-growing areas in the country, particularly cooking apples. So it's really good to see a small orchard like this being established.
But, I mean, apple trees are very resilient once they get established, if they're a good stock.
In most areas of the country, there's like a microclimate. This area is very dry. Mm. In addition, you get cold east winds, which you don't get further west. So further west in Gloucestershire, Devon and Cornwall, you get lots of cider apples, you get lots of pears, peri pears as well. Mm. Of course, the weather is a little bit wetter and it isn't quite as cold over there.
Mm. Lots of people come here and enjoy this place. You know, there's lots of birthday parties here, and I got married here, right here, where we're standing.
Oh, they had a wonderful time in Merry Old England.
Didn't they, though?
So, he sent out a message. Through his toes, through the fibres that joined his rooty toes to every other tree in the forest. And it might be nice here if we could join together by the toes. There we go. The message going through our toes is this. Stop the storms. Eat the storm clouds. Stop the storms.
Heed the storm cloud.
And all of the trees put out their branches, being very careful not to bash each other in the face.
One, two.
Here's to thee, old apple tree that blooms well, bears well. Hats full, caps full, 3 bushel bags full, and all under one tree. The Trumpington Orchard Wassail brings together the local community, and after some storytelling, everyone forms around the oldest apple tree, called the King Tree.
You start with the King Tree.
Well, it's giving an offering to the tree. It's kind of like saying thank you for what you did for us last year with the apples.
It's an apple tree that's grown from a pip. It's an old sport, and we didn't actually know it was there till we cleared back some of the cherry trees.
And we're going to give you a little bit of sustenance in the middle of the winter.
We decorate it, and we pour apple juice around the ground to encourage it, you know, to grow well and have a good crop.
And now we should honour this ancient tree, which has stood for many a year and borne apples for those who came before us. The ancestral tree of the land, the King Tree. We shall give it its offerings.
That's Nigel Pennock, a central character to the Trumpington Wassail. He is the Lord of Misrule.
I come from the land of Cockayne. I bring with me all good things, all fruit in abundance. I call upon the spirits of the land to bring us what we need. Let the music commence. Let the wassail begin. Hip hip!
Hooray!
Hip hip!
Hooray!
Hip hip!
Hooray!
We're very lucky because Nigel Pennock, Lord of Misrule, is a very enthusiastic folk musician and he comes and leads the music every year.
Well, Susanna just told me that everything is built around you.
Well, no, I mean, it's the orchard is the main thing, and it's the trees. Let us be, let everyone lift up the cup and health to the apple tree.
How you guys can play in this cold? My hands have already frozen up.
We're okay. What I do like to see at these events, though, is at one Wassail went to, they use black powder shotguns, and a couple of gamekeeper chaps fire them up into the air. And the idea being you want to stir up the apple gods, and then you also want to banish the evil spirits. But it would be a bit scary to fire off guns in the edge of Trumpington on a Sunday afternoon, I think.
We have had party poppers in the past.
Party poppers?
Because, I mean, it's making a bang, making a loud noise. Yeah. It's like driving away the evil spirits. Yeah, that's what it's about. Drums and...
Rough music.
That's right. Rantantanning. But that's right. That's driving someone out of town as well, that is. Yeah. That's a different kind of thing.
Happy New Year! How are you?
Well, it is a Happy New Year. It's a Happy New Growing Year, isn't it?
OK, we're going to process now. After everyone's put their toast on the tree.
I think the concept of making a toast actually comes from the wassail. Hmm.
And I got speaking to someone who sold herself as the chicken lady, and the chicken lady told me that the hanging toast in the tree tradition is the where we get toasting from, as in to toast a drink with someone. I found a good tree to hang my toast in, and yeah, it's very enjoyable.
What's going on in the tub here? We're gonna bob for apples?
Oh, no. This is an old English wassail bowl.
Ooh.
Anybody for apple juice, please come and get seconds.
There's loads.
I really don't want to drink all week, so please come and take it.
I'd ought to bring up the volume a little.
You will sing like a bird.
I hold the holly, the life most jolly.
Some sounds of slurping.
Ah, lovely.
That's not too alcoholic.
Oh, yeah, no, don't worry. It's got no alcohol in it.
Oh, well.
That's why we've been feeding it to all the children.
You know that this recipe's hundreds of years old?
Is that so? Well, I toast the long line of tipplers who have perpetuated such a noble tradition.
I'm fond of drinkers myself.
And how does that hot drink taste on a day like today?
This mulled apple juice is lovely. It's really warming me right to the cockles. I'm very much enjoying it.
And their buds open. Their leaves unfurled. And as the storm clouds came up, what did they do?
There's 4,000 or 5,000 varieties of apples. Commercially, very few are grown now. And what you don't want to do is to lose the old original varieties.
They ate them.
Of course, you might need them in the future, you know, to breed the fresh apples. I think in the Cambridge area, there's always been a tradition of fruit growing, even strawberries.
Yes.
Did I tell you about the Burwell Community Orchard?
No.
We planted it yesterday morning.
Oh, wow.
Yes. It was brilliant.
That's great, yeah. Yeah, community orchards have become a big thing because this country used to provide a lot of our fruit from orchards, like nuts, apples, cherries. Mm. A lot of it's imported from abroad now.
Well, there were some historical jam
that's
companies
right.
here as
that's
well.
That's right, Chivers.
Chivers, Histon,
yeah.
Hacker's Fruit Farm off the A14 and so on.
Plums.
Still there, yeah.
Plums and greengages were very popular. Black currants as well, you know.
Well, of course, the other thing south of here is peas at Sawston and round there.
Yeah,
and
peas
Salford.
And beans.
Peas and beans, yeah.
Peas and beans.
A sort of local soils again.
Yeah.
Bit of advice for you young people. Look after the earth. Plant more trees. Spring is coming, they said. Thank you.
Thank you. Right. Are we ready for the next bit?
Yes. What a wonderful audience.
And that was wassailing at Trumpington Community Orchard, the ancient toast and celebration of the apple tree.
Mm.
How many people were there?
I think there's about good 50 plus people.
Oh, it's popular.
Yeah, freezing cold day, but lovely. And yes, many thanks to Trumpington Orchard project team who organised it all. Founder members Kerry Galloway and Susanna Colacco, Nigel Pennick, and of course storyteller at the end there, Rachel O'Leary, and many more. They assure me that the orchard will be there for the foreseeable future, as they have an agreement with the City Council and they intend to keep it as a central part of their community, especially with Great Knighton springing up next to it. You can see their project online at trumpingtonorchard.org. And there's Green Onion signalling the start of our new section. We begin with jobs.
The Ivy in Trinity Street is looking for a sous chef. Apply via the Ivy's website.
Shelford Deli wants a kitchen porter who will take responsibility for the pot wash section. This is a short or a long-term job and no experience is necessary. Pay is £8.50 an hour. Pop in to discuss or hand in your application to them, a CV with a covering letter.
Two vacancies for head chefs at City Pub Group establishments in Cambridge. One is at the old ticket office by the station, where the pay is from £28,000 to £30,000 per annum. The other is at the old bicycle shop in Regent Street. Pay there, £35,000 per annum. You can apply via the City Pub Group website.
News about Cambridge Market now. There is concern amongst market traders and Cambridge residents that there may be a move to take the market out of Market Square. Julian Clover asked Liz Herbert, the leader of Cambridge City Council, about this on Cambridge Breakfast a couple of weeks ago.
There seems to be, I don't know, this worry that the market could maybe come out of its location opposite the Guildhall.
No, the market will stay where it is, and the opportunities which we'll discuss are how can we afford to improve it? Just having a decent surface for people, decent surface to clean, decent surface for children and older people to walk across, which it isn't currently good enough on, will cost a large sum of money, Julian. Mm. And we've got to do an assessment of what some of those options are. And then we'll talk to people. And we know how passionate people are. And there are not many independent sort of small traders in the city. And that's fundamental to the success of the market and the city. Yeah. We are a market town.
Well, that seems very clear and unequivocal, but anxieties have been raised by the Greater Cambridgeshire Partnership, which wants to set out improvements to what it calls the public realm around the Market Square in order to make better use of the space. The issue may simply be to find a way of keeping the market where it is while allowing more social use of the square in the evenings. There is a target for any proposals to go to public consultation this coming June. And if you're at all concerned about the market, you may want to join the Friends of Cambridge Market Group, which you can find details of online.
And you can hear the whole of that interview with Lewis Herbert on the Cambridge 105 radio website.
But Seedy Sunday is coming up next Sunday. It's the event at which you can buy seeds very cheaply and also get your hands on some very unusual heritage seeds. It's being held on the 27th January, Trumpington Village Hall, 1:30 to 4 p.m. Entry is £2 for adults and free for children. WIs are providing tea and cakes on sale. And Alan tells me that they are really marvellous. Also be stands from Trumpington Community Orchard and Transition Cambridge.
And the opening of Thirsty and Hungry in King Street has been put back now until early February. This will be in the premises previously occupied by Urban Shed. And Mark Poynton, ex-Alimentum, is overseeing the food, so you can expect something to really look forward to.
And if your New Year's resolution includes developing cooking skills, there are 22 cookery classes in the month of February alone at Cambridge Cookery and Bistro in Purbeck Street off Hills Road, and they do sell out all of January's have. So here are a few you might be interested in. On the 2nd of February from 10 till 2, gorgeously gluten-free, baking gluten-free items from pancakes to pizza bases and pasta. The cost is £150. On the 3rd of February, a sourdough baking masterclass, which is not for beginners. It runs from 10 till 2:15 and also costs £150. And on the 8th of February, learn from Joe Krajinska. Yes, Joe will be teaching how to bake such things as a classic sponge, chocolate cake with cream cheese filling, gluten-free apple crumble friands and cheese scones. That's Friday the 8th of February, 11 till 3, costs £135.
And by the way, Cambridge Cookery and Bistro is Cambridge's first zero-waste business, and we hope to hear more about that on the next programme.
And for our listeners who are having a dry January, let's give you a couple of events to look forward to. On the 5th of February at Cambridge Wine Merchants in Cherry Hinton Road, it's Gin Club. There will be five gins and you will be finding the perfect garnish to have with them. It doesn't always have to be lime or lemon. It starts at 7 p.m, costs £15, and you can book via the Eventbrite website or phone Cambridge 214 553.
Also at Cambridge Wine Merchants, but this time at the Cambridge University Centre, next to the Mill Pub, there's a tasting of vegan, biodynamic and organic wines. It's £5 to get in, and you then pay as you go with tokens you purchase. Book via Eventbrite.
And that's all we have time for today. We are repeated on Sundays at 2 o'clock and then podcast early next week.
And if you'd like to get in touch with any news or comment when we're off the air, you can email us, flavour@cambridge105.co.uk, or contact us on Twitter, @flavour105.
Coming up on Cambridge 105 Radio today, at 2 o'clock, Women Making Waves. 3 o'clock, Cambridge Wish List, in which Heidi Allen talks to Tony Barnfield about her life and her treasured tracks. 4 till 5 this week, the best of Cambridge 105. 5 until 6, the Cambridge football show, The Results. 6 till 8, Chris Brown's Soul and Dance Show. 8 until 9, Sweet Revenge. 9 until 11, Paul Cristoforo with Rock of Ages. And 11 till 1, Club Beats. But that's all from us for today. Flavour will be back on the 2nd of February, so until then,
goodbye.